Right. Well, welcome, everyone. I'm very pleased this afternoon to be able to introduce Dr. Yuka Kadoy, whom I've known for some years. Dr. Kadoy is the project leader at the Faculty of Historical and Cultural Studies at the Department of Art History at the University of Vienna, sponsored by the Austrian Science Fund. Her main research interests include the mobility of artifacts, the history of collecting, museum studies, and art historiography, with the focus on the Persian cultural sphere. She's the author of Islamic Shinazori, The Art of Mongol Iran, from Edinburgh University Press in 2009, and a paperback edition in 2018, and a forthcoming monograph on the 20th century history and historiography of Persian art in global contexts. This is provisionally entitled The History and Historiography of Persian Art, 1900 to 1935, this is under contract also with Edinburgh University Press. Besides numerous journal articles and book chapters, she is the editor or co-editor of a variety of volumes, including The Shaping of Persian Art from 2013, Arthur Upham Pope and a New Survey of Persian Art 2016, Persian Art Image Making in Eurasia 2018, The Blue Road Mastercrafts from Persia 2018, and The Reshaping of Persian Art 2019. She has a long-standing working relationship with Scottish Academy, including her graduate education and her postdoctoral positions here. And drawing on her research project and forthcoming monograph, her BIP seminar today will explore the trajectories of one of the most celebrated classical Persian carpets to survive today as a case study. So Dr. Kadoy, the floor, as it were, metaphorically, is over to you.
So, first of all, I'd like to warmly thank Andrew, Sylvia, and BIP's staff members for inviting me to give a talk. And it's always nice to get back to at least virtually, to the UK to get involved academic activities. So today I'd like to share a tiny bit of my research findings, not only within the context of Persian art in Central and East Europe in early 20th century, a subject of my current research project sponsored by the Austrian Science Fund, but also in transcontinental context. I also like to extend a discussion into the second half of the 20th century in my BIP's talk today. So I hope you enjoy my talk. Many visitors cannot resist the fascination of a particular ambience inside the carpet galleries at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, known as MET in New York, and Austrian Museum of Applied Art, known as MAP in Vienna. This fascination often evokes the story of magic carpet found in 1000 Nights. While this story is more likely to be anecdotal than factual, it could have been inspired by actual incidents in which a carpet appeared to travel across time and space. And perhaps more than any other medium of cultural mobility, carpet acquired different functions and meanings as they moved around and could serve as gift exchange, booty, commodities, or object of cultural devotion. Originally woven in a modern-day Iran during the 16th century, one of the most celebrated classical Persian carpet to survive until today, the Sangsuko carpet, currently housed at the Miho Museum in Japan, made an extraordinary intercontinental journey. It found a way to Europe as early as the pre-modern period and continued its journey across the Atlantic Ocean in the early 20th century. Furthermore, the carpet went on an odyssey across the Pacific Ocean afterwards. A fresh analysis of its social-cultural migratory journey therefore serves to shed new light on the mechanisms of cross-continental object sharing and networking across the different oceanic spheres. My big talk today is based on the chapter I have published in 2021 in a volume called The Seas and Mobilities of Islamic Art, published by Yale University Press. And the first half of my chapter with a focus on the Emperor's carpet from the former Habsburg collection on the left-hand side, is now in the Met collection in New York, was the main subject of my lecture given to my project workshop in Vienna last year. And I have the poster on the right-hand side. So today, I'm not really talking about Emperor's Carpet, but I will mention this carpet quite frequently during my BIPS talk. So please keep this image and name in your mind. And also, those who have attended my workshop lecture on the Emperor's Carpet last year, please take my BIPS talk as a second case study of the modern trajectories of Persian classical carpet. So back to the main topic of discussion. Named after the previous owner, the Sangsko carpet represents one of the most recognizable groups of Safavid carpet, which are hence often labeled the Sangsko group. And I'm sorry, this naming is a bit like a commercial company, by the way. But there are many funny terms in the carpet scholarship, so please bear with me. So I you know, group and class and style and types and so on. So this is just the terminology we have to use. So on the left-hand side, we have the Sangsko carpet as a prototype. And in the middle, we have the velvet fragment now in the Met collection in New York. And this fragment was in fact also formerly in the Sangsko collection until the mid 20s. And according to the provenance record of this fragment, it was sold to an American collector based in New York. And this collector owned this carpet, this fragment until 1927. When it was given to the Metropolitan Museum of Art as a gift. On the right-hand side, we have the Waterhouse carpet. And this carpet was exhibited at the Epic Iran exhibition at the V&A last year. And I myself could not travel to London to see this carpet on display due to COVID. But I have recently reviewed the exhibition catalog for Abstract Iranica in Paris. Other related pieces and fragments belonging to the Sangsko group are scattered across the different collections. And in total, some 15 examples can be identified. And some of this kind are, for instance, found in a textile museum, the George Washington University Museum in Washington, DC. What is the main common feature in the Sangsko group is obviously a design, which is based on hunting iconography and consisting of hunters, animals, angels, etc. Hence, it is also generally called the hunting carpet. And this suggests that this type of woven material may originally constituted a part of the tent hanging. This interpretation seems to be based on the legend that the Sangsko carpet was taken from the Ottomans as a war booty by the House of Sangsko, a Polish and Lithuanian aristocratic family at the Battle of Hochin in modern-day Ukraine in 1621. This war booty narrative reminds us of a similar attribution, namely the Siege of Vienna in 1683, which many other classical Persian carpets in European aristocratic collections are supposed to have in their provenance record. And for instance, the Emperor's carpet from a former Habsburg collection and the velvet fragment from the former Sangsko collection, both are currently in the Met Museum in New York, are said to have once formed the part of the interior of a tent used by the Ottomans during the Siege of Vienna. So here, I wish to provoke the following question. Is there any concrete evidence to support the war booty narrative? While we cannot deny the existence of the Sangsko carpet in the Polish-Ukrainian border region at some point in history, we can certainly question the exact circumstances behind the departure of the Sangsko carpet from modern-day Iran or its otherwise uncertain place of production somewhere in West Asia and its trajectories from West Asia to Anatolia and then to Europe via the Balkans, or possibly traveling across the Black Sea or Caspian Sea or even the Baltic Sea. So if the carpet that later came to be known as the Sangsko carpet was not brought to the battlefield as tent furnishings by the Ottomans. How this carpet ended up with East Europe? It is widely known that the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth became one of the major commercial hubs in early modern Europe, where a number of luxurious, let's say, Oriental luxuries arrived through a mercantile and diplomatic channels. Now, whatever the real circumstances might have been, one point is clear. The carpet found its way to the border region of modern-day Poland and Ukraine and came into the possession of the Sangskos at some point in history, despite under unknown circumstances, and stayed at one of the Sangskos' seat of residence for a specific duration of time. And the Sangskos had a lot of the residences across the region. And one of the residents, I just show you the photos, Izraslav, which is now ruined. So the existence of the carpet remained largely unknown until the early 20th century, when it is said to have put on public display on occasion of an exhibition of arts and crafts in St. Petersburg in 1904. It seems to have gained a certain degree of public recognition on a local level. However, it was only in the 1920s, around the time of the international debut of the Emperor's Carpet, that the existence of a similarly impressive carpet was more forcefully publicized by the owner himself, Prince Roman Sangsko, a Polish landowner, horse breeder, industrialist and philanthropist. Sangsko's act of self-promotion can be interpreted in multiple ways, ranging from his attempt to restore declining family fortune to a means of sponsoring his lavish lifestyle. In contrast with the usual carpet dealing at that time, however, Prince Sangsko appears to have taken the initiative of selling his carpet into his own hands, rather than getting several external consultants involved. In terms of his ethical mindset, hunting iconography was a perfect fit for enhancing his self-orientalizing image as an accomplished horse breeder, as well as for generating his self-historicizing image as an aristocratic commander on hunting expeditions. Apart from his self-image-making strategy, there must have been a financial reason behind the selling of the Sangsko carpet. So thanks to the survival of archival records, such as one of the letters found in the Dumbarton Oaks archives in Washington, DC, we are now able to trace the Prince's sales strategy. On the screen, I show you the extract from the letter dated 1928, and it was sent by a royal tailor to Mildred Blitz. Tyler was an American diplomat who got deeply involved with US foreign affairs after the First World War, including his senior role at the League of Nations and especially overseeing the economic reconstruction of Hungary. And that's why this letter was sent from Budapest, where he was often staying. Besides his diplomatic duty, he was a quite active art consultant, and who advised the founders of the Dumbarton Oaks, Robert and Mildred Bliss, and often served as their agent in Europe in terms of finding nice things for them and also processing payment and also dealing with logistics. So now I'd like to go through this letter sentence by sentence to identify which object the letter is referring, and how so-called war booty narrative was constructed. But although the following identification of specific objects of specific carpets or textiles is more or less, I hope, accurate. And I do, of course, rule out, of course, kind of my shortcomings. But this is a great thing by using 20th century archival materials, because this is the time we also have photographic evidence, which I'm going to show you in a minute. So we need to get to know more about a lot of things about what's going on during this time in terms of the object sharing. So here, I read this letter quickly. So what the Bisbis has is a marvelous set of panels or figure, 16th century Persian velvet. And by the way, this, the name, a guy called Bisbis, I don't know. He seems to be the one of the dealer based in Paris or elsewhere in Europe. Anyway, so this guy had a very nice Persian velvet and a decoration of a tent, interesting, of a very finest quality, like the few pieces in the Lyon Museum, but bigger. And he has sold one of them to the Boston Museum, blah, blah, blah. So here, I'm able to identify one of the velvet, which is this one, which is actually, yes, now in the Boston Museum of Fine Art. And in fact, it is from the Sangusko collection. So now back to the letter. So he told me that the lot came from the Miss Sangusko, yes, head of the great Polish house, and was a part of a tent captured from the Turks as the siege of Vienna. So this is the way how the Warburton narrative was constructed. So this kind of a story is becoming kind of reality. And this is a very fascinating way to look at, you know, this documentation, because normally if we visit a museum and look at the label information, we don't doubt the information about the provenance. We say, oh yes, this is from Sangusko, but how and when, and so all questions you may have. But we have to really get into this archival record to see it is true that this is really came from this Wobuti context. But anyway, so I'm just explaining again by reading the next paragraph. So I dare to say it is true, so maybe, but now we think probably not true. So he also told me that Sangusko still has the carpet. So now the question, which carpet, the title is talking about, which went with the tent. You see, this is how this narrative was constructed. So this carpet is actually the Sangusko carpet. So this is, of course, very interesting to know. And then this letter is talking about this, what is a good condition and the finest fountain carpet, everything, and blah, blah, blah. And then the world with the border angels, like the Vienna one, and the varied hunting scenes. Sangusko has this carpet, this is our Sangusko carpet, in a bank in Paris. This is also very interesting. So, in fact, this carpet was in Paris already, not in the Polish-Ukrainian border region by this time. And he was away when I was there, but Bisbis says he will get leave for me to see it in June and after the Geneva meeting. And Sangusko is said to want a £50,000 for it. And I hear that Behar, and actually Behar is a very famous carpet dealer based in Glasgow and also London, and who has the carpet. The question is this the same carpet? No, this carpet is actually the emperor's carpet, sold from the Vienna Museum a couple of years ago and wanted £200,000. And that the Vienna carpet, which is the emperor's carpet, though and one thing and blah, blah, blah. And in fact, Behar was involved in the dealing of the emperor's carpet. And so he made a fortune for selling this piece. So I just wanted to show you how we can utilize this variable documentation for telling the different stories of the, let's say, the Persian artifacts. And this is one of the methodology I have been developing for a number of decades, I mean, a long time. And I'm very confident that I can really tell totally different stories about the Persian art history. And probably around the same time as the letter was sent, Sangusco carpet was spotted by an American historian of Persian art, Arthur Upham Pope. Having seen the potential of the carpet as an imposing piece of art that could dominate a huge gallery in terms of size and visual terms, the Pope managed to establish a loan agreement with Prince Sangusco, and the carpet was shown at International Exhibition of Persian Art in London in 1931, where it caused a great sensation. And according to one of the exhibition installation photographs on the right-hand side, the Sangusco carpet was on display in a gallery dedicated to so-called masterpieces, which is, you can also see it on the floor, on the, I'll put it in a red circle. So the special status of the Sangusco carpet was further underlined by Pope in the chapter on carpet in his very famous Survey of Persian Art, published in 1938-39, which states that, here I quote, the Sangusco type was fully recognized as a class at the London Exhibition, end quote. So again, the Pope was also using this terminologies like type and class. And so now, of course, if we analyze these terminologies, it's kind of funny, but this is the way how this discourse was formulating. And this is also important things to bear in mind. So although the Sangusco carpet already made an incredible journey, it could not stop its mobile lifestyle, I'm afraid, and due to the deteriorating geopolitical situation in Europe. The outbreak of World War II forced the prince to abandon many of his estates. Prince Sangusco left the Polish-Ukrainian border region in September 1939, when the Red Army entered this region. He ended his sojourn in Lisbon in Portugal in June 1940, and set out a transcontinental journey, not to North America, but to South America, to seek refuge in Brazil. His famous carpet, however, did not accompany the prince's journey up to the New World. But the carpet was then on loan to a Pope, who became a kind of a guardian of the carpet for the next 15 years. During the 1940s and early 1950s, the carpet remained under the care of Pope and stayed largely out of the spotlight and almost like a refugee and apart from the special occasions. For instance, it is said that the carpet was put on display at the Pope's Asia Institute on the upper east side of Manhattan for the visit of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1949. Unfortunately, I do not have the photo showing the carpet on display at the Institute premises, but the photo of the grand staircase gives you some idea how the Sangusco carpet could have been displayed together with other woven pieces. Yet Pope's Institute could not serve as a permanent home for the Sangusco carpet. The situation changed in the mid-1950s when the carpet crossed Fifth Avenue to enter the collection of Metropolitan Museum of Art as a loan, recommended by Pope, who retired from public life after the closure of his institute in 1954 and later left the United States permanently for Iran. Although this change of guardianship did not involve a cross-continental endeavor, the Sangusco carpet was once again forced to carry out another moving. At the same time, this little moving means that for some decades in the second half of the 20th century, the emperor's carpet and Samsko carpet once existed in Central and East Europe, and both left Europe for North America and became present at the same institution in New York. Although they may have shared the same storage venue, they were neither displayed side by side nor publicized together as a notable object of transatlantic cultural transfer. Having been inherited by Prince Paul Sangusko after the death of Prince Roman Sangusko in 1984, the Sangusko carpet resurfaced on the art market in the late 1980s. In order to understand its background, it is necessary to shift our attention back to Iran after Cook settled in Shiraz in 1966, when Ackerman and also their famous Persian girls. One of the Pope's students, Jay Clark, played a key role in the relocation and the organization of Pope's Institute, known as Asia Institute. Together with his wife, Sumi, Clark was instrumental for the restoration and utilization of Narenstan, one of the important Qajar palaces, as a new research center of Persian history and culture located in Iran. They also played an essential part in the reissuing of course, the Pope's famous survey of Persia in Japan, as well as the publication of their important volume entitled A Survey of Persian Handicraft, a pictorial introduction to the contemporary folk arts and artscrafts of modern Iran. Furthermore, Rak was also acting as an art consultant, collector, and more likely a dealer. Through the mediation of Rak, the Sangusko carpet resumed its journey to the Asian side of the Pacific Ocean, where it became a part of the founding collection of the Miho Museum, a private religious cultural institution built in the deeply forested countryside near the Japanese town of Shigaraki in Shiga Prefecture. Since the public opening of the museum in 1997, the Sangusko carpet had been on display at one of the iconic structures designed by a very famous Chinese-American architect, Ian Pei, known for his visionary concept in museum architecture. For the first time in the lifetime of this famous carpet, the peaceful utopian architectural setting of the Miho Museum complex enables the Sangusko carpet to create a harmonious dialogue with other objects displayed within the gallery. Having survived the century-long dislocation and long-distance journey, the Sangusko carpet became one of the key objects that have experienced mobility dynamics, encompassing some 400 years and different continents, apart from Africa. In contrast to the emperor's carpet and other examples of classical Persian carpet, which usually made up to two oceanic journeys within the established contact zone between Europe and North America, the Sangusko carpet eventually found, perhaps rather unexpectedly, a permanent home on the fringe of the Pacific Ocean, while the owner himself went on its voyage to Latin America. Regardless of its obscure provenance prior to modern times, the Sangusko carpet exemplifies the power of portable objects that can bridge several oceanic spheres, and above all, serves to represent the cultural mobility of Persian woven treasures as a perfect evocation of flying carpets. And thank you very much for your attention. So if you have any questions, I'm very happy to answer.
Thank you, Yuka, very much. That was a fascinating discussion. It certainly did a world traveling all over the place. I presume it's still there in Japan and can be seen by people who go?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Almost permanently in the same gallery, as far as I know.
Hmm.
And it's a huge piece, of course, so it's not easy to move. But it's very nice that, the carpet is not a human, but it's like a, more like a human, you know, to made such a long, tedious journey and finally now kind of a retirement mood. That one can feel it if you visit, you know, the gallery. And today I hope we understand all this complex background of the carpet. Okay, if you go to now the gallery, we only see the carpet, but this more interesting point is actually to know the history behind it. And this is actually my kind of duty to tell different stories of each present object. And this is also another way to tell different stories and also different history, let's say, of each object.
Excellent. Okay, well, I'm taking questions on the Zoom Q&A function. I have one of the earliest comments was from someone who was in Istanbul airport en route to Samarkand and had to rush to make the connection, but says thank you for the program and that they will watch it on the recording. So use this as an opportunity to say to anybody that this will be available on YouTube, and its availability there will be announced on our various other social media platforms as well. Someone who came late, a couple of people who came late also, I think the answer is the same. You should be able to look at the BIPS YouTube channel, and I would encourage you to sign up and become a member of the BIPS YouTube channel as well and hold on to those. There is a question here. Has the role of this particular carpet been seen in other traditional and special works? That is this unique, or are we looking at similar journeys for other kinds of things from, I'm particularly being someone interested in the Safavid period, of those initial ideas of how it moved from Iran into the Ottomans and then up. So do we have any other examples of any material, particularly for that period, would be my special question as a kind of an overview of this general question that this person is raising.
Oh, okay. So, well, in fact, there are many stories, of course, and famous stories is a manuscript, of course. And I'm not the manuscript expert. But I know many stories about the Persian manuscripts moved one different library, and then of course this is the reason Istanbul has the biggest the finest collection of Persian manuscripts. And this was a war booty, but also in Russia too. So this is one story about Persian manuscripts. And then I'm more or less working on carpet because carpet also, we have to, amend all of this wrong information, like a war booty story, which actually we have to do a lot of things, to be honest. And then of course, anything portable, like metalwork, there are many stories about, because normally we don't pay so much attention to this kind of detail, but the one is getting into checking all of these objects now in museums, I'm talking about not in a recent accessions, but if we look at the 19th century and early 20th century, normally some complex but interesting stories. Also, in early modern period, yes, there are many stories about this, how this oriental luxury is moved from place to another. But this is, I must say, I'm not the early modern expert, but there are many researchers now working on this question because particularly in this region, like Central Europe and East Europe, there are so many things to tell. So far, we haven't done so many things, but now we have a very good research group and working together, like Ottomanists and also European art historians, for instance. We work together and how this all of these items, ended up with different collections. But also the sad story I have to tell you that normally in during the early 20th century, many things left from this region due to the confusion of the wars. Mm-hmm. So this is another complicated story. I'm more working on 20th century story part, but maybe the future, we try to connect all the stories. Yeah. So early modern period, after modern period, but it's a huge, huge project. But it's true, yes, there are many, many stories to tell.
I have a question here about the, if there is any evidence that the Japanese in particular have a tradition of collecting Persian carpets or Persian artifacts. Was there a particular pre-existing interest, I guess?
Of course, you know, there's a collection of, we call it Persian, but in fact Indian, by the way, the Deccan carpets, who came through the Dutch traders in early modern period, or this is before the 20th century, and during the Edo period. So we have this, the early arrival of the Persian or Indian carpet and textiles in Japan, are normally used for like the festival, like a Gion festival. And these are all very famous stories. But this is a one group. And so we still can see this, the old collection of, the Persian textiles and carpets in Japan. But also there's another, like a modern collection, modern part of the 20th century collection of Persian art in Japan. And this is, again, another interesting story. Whether there's any connection, this is another story. But there's a collection already before. And also, even before, a long time ago, of course, the time of the Silk Road, for instance, a long time ago, of course, in the Shoshoin, there are some so-called Persian, but by the way, it's not in Persian, maybe the Chinese copies of Persian artifacts, but like glass and all this metalwork, and supposedly maybe post Tang Dynasty or maybe post Sasanian time, maybe, but we don't know exactly. But there are some old collections as well. Japan has a very interesting Persian art collections. And so far, there's a kind of fragmentary attempts to to tell all of the stories. But now there's also the movement to gather all the information to tell more coherent story. This is not only there in Japan, but also all over in Asia, for instance. Not only in Europe, because in Europe and the American museums, we pretty much know, I don't say everything, but we know, all the stories. But more interesting point is how Asians, other part of Asians, view Persian art and how they collect it or how they use and all this interesting question. So this is another big topic someone has to work on it.
I have several questions that relate to Gluck and the Mihu Museum itself. I guess I could possibly, without doing disservice to any of the questioners, ask why this particular museum and what was Gluck's role in this transaction, this mediation between the Mihu Museum or other buyers in Japan. Was there competition, for example, for the carpet back in Japan?
What I know is actually the Jay Gluck's wife, Sumi, she came from the western part of Japan. And so the Miho Museum is also located not so far from where this Sumi came from. So there's a kind of a local connections, let's say. And I don't know why this connection was forming. Exactly, but this is a one kind of possible connection through the wife, the Sumi, who was of course very much instrumental. She was not really so obviously, putting her in the publications. She put her name, but for the communications in Japan, of course she did many things. Already this kind of local connection Gluck has. In that particular part of Japan. So this is the one thing I could imagine. Then probably there's an idea that the Shumei religious group wanted to set up a museum. And so there's a kind of internal discussion, but I don't know exactly about this all details. Interesting question, but this is only I can say through his wife. So this is a local connection.
Two related questions then about the museum. One questioner asks, at the time of the purchase, who was the official owner of the carpet?
At the time is actually the Paul Sanguisco was inheriting the main owner, like a Roman Sanguisco. So the Paul was I think still alive, and he was in Brazil. He was the last, let's say, owner of the carpet. And so maybe I think the owner, the Paul also probably wanted to sell, maybe. I don't know exactly detail. So there's a kind of negotiation going on, probably, yes.
And another questioner asks, again, are there other Persian or Oriental carpets at the museum?
Yes, they have some. Actually, very good ones. And Miho has a very interesting, eclectic collection, but it's a very good one. But the best is actually, of course, the Sanguisco carpet, which is, of course, huge and also beautiful. So it's one of the most famous ones. But yes, they have more carpet, yes.
Can I ask, at the museum itself, if one were to go there, how do they describe the acquisition or the journey, the travel? How do they?
Their website, I think, it needs to be a bit edited, I think. It's a bit old information. They refer to this war booty story. And so this is the story we are told in before. But today I'm presenting alternative story. So if museum likes it, maybe they take my story. But I don't rule out this, the war booty story, because in a way we don't have any evidence. that's the problem. So it could be the case, but we just don't know. Two possibilities, but according to my understanding is we just don't know, and it's likely that this carpet was somehow immersed in the early 20th century. I don't know, I don't have a strong evidence for this. But the museum still using this the war booty narrative. But this is only not just the Miho Museum, but there's many other museums actually in across the world. If they have carpets, they normally use this war booty story, or some other nice, interesting, dramatic stories. But that's a problem. But at the same time, we have no real evidence. Also, my story too, I have some evidence to prove my hypothesis, but at the same time, this is, I'm not a museum curator, so they have, they have their own understanding.
Of course, there were gifts exchanged between the Ottomans and the Safavids in the early period as well. In the first Safavid century and later on as well, some of those things are recorded indirectly through other people's other scholarly works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and a colleague of mine is working on this all of these documents in this Crimean region. There are so many this documentation about what kind of objects trade. Across this Black Sea. I see these descriptions of objects, but this is again, we have to be very careful. Yes, there are so many like carpets, the question is at that time, is there any distinction, for instance, between Turkish and Ottoman carpets? This is also an interesting question. Also, there are so many descriptions about old objects, but can we associate this textual record with the we have now in the museums? This is another tricky thing, because today, that's why I demonstrated that with using archive and maybe photographic documentation, yes, we can be a bit sure about the identification objects. But in early modern sources, I'm very careful, you know. I'm not an early modern expert, but you know. So yes, we have documentation about all objects traded, but again, I don't rule out this. You know, this maybe yes, you know, the carpet was one of the gifts. Yeah, maybe sure. But once again, another question is this carpet was so huge, it's huge and also heavy, and so okay, you know. At that time, it was so precious gift for they could carry, but this is a totally different logistics, you know, compared with like the gemstones, and it's a huge. So again, we have to think about realistically. So it's a really lot of, you know, should be a strong reason to bring that huge, you know, object into, you know, that part of the, you know, huge, you know, long journey. So I'm still thinking about this the early modern chapter of the carpets, Sanskrit carpet. But we have to still work on it.
All right, we have time for a few more questions. Here's one. Given the number of the elite objects left before Vienna when the Ottomans left in 1688, why do you now express some doubts about that source for the brilliant shaped velvets you cite at the beginning of the talk? What's the origins of the doubt? Because there were a lot of these kinds of objects that were
it's true.
About at that time.
Yeah, I mean, yes, we have a lot of things in here. And is it true that all of these things, you know, it really came through this more booty context. I'm just proposing the different alternative story to me it more makes sense. But I don't say that all things here in Vienna are, you know, arriving in the 19th century, 20th century, but maybe some definitely came through this context, the World War II context, yes. But we also have to check each object, is it true that it came from this context and different context? So I'm just proposing, you know, the another way to approach object now we have in a different context. And you know, this kind of old contextualization is I sometimes need to be revived. And if it's true, it's fine. But you know, we can also get back to this old question. And so this is actually I just proposed, you know, today. And this is a huge topic. Obviously, I only focus on this Persian stuff. But imagine like all this Ottoman stuff that we have here in Vienna is huge. And but I'm doing Ottoman material. So. I'm just focusing on Persian stuff, but I'm just proposing a different take.
One questioner here suggests that maybe it was something in the booty acquired by Sultan Salim, or that it was in Shah Ismail's palace in Tabriz after the Battle of Chaldiran.
Maybe. Of course, you know, there's a lot of things that we can tell. I'm open to any, you know, interpretation. So in this study, yes, I'm more pushing this my ideas about, you know, the more early 20th century context, but it's true, yes. We can also connect with our modern period for sure, yeah.
And one colleague notes that carpets were produced in Iran for the kings of Poland.
Yeah, true.
And
yeah.
Some of these have been missing since the war.
Yeah. So, you see, yes. So, we still have a lot of things to do in this region. to be honest. Yeah, so it's I hope that this my talk generate interest in this topic, because we are actually now good time to get back to this old narratives, Woguti and all this so-called Polish carpet and all these interesting stories. This is also, I hope I can explore in my next book, hopefully. But thanks very much for giving me opportunity today to share my ideas. And it's great. And also good questions and suggestions.
I just want to ask one more. I'm not a carpet person myself, but when one looks at this carpet, can we say anything about the location in which it might have been produced? And can we say anything about the uniqueness of the design patterns? Or are the patterns common, or is this quite unique piece of work?
Yeah, this is all the problems in the carpet scholarship. We have this maybe 10 man, and maybe always probably. So we cannot be sure. But the only thing we can do is make a kind of group according to design. But it might be the case that the examples I've shown today came from all different workshops in the different locations, but just according to similar design. And even I'm not sure whether it's really produced in the modern day Iranian national border, maybe in somewhere. So yes, it's very difficult, it's tricky. It's very tricky. This also we have to think about what.
Okay. All right, fine. Thank you very much. That's great. Yuka, thank you very much. Yep, one more question. In your expert opinion, do the motifs of the carpet express a story and a narrative in some sort of complex way? And for example, is there a root in mysticism or philosophy that are tied to art and mathematics, getting into the design of it itself?
I must say that yes, I'm not really the expert of this the carpet designing horizons, but there are many studies about this iconography and also the design, the geometry and all things. But it's true. I mean, some carpets have this very complex design, and it has a very unique meanings. And of course, there are many literatures about it. And hunting, normally hunting carpet is related to the hunting, of course. And this is all kind of old theme in the Persian culture and the Oriental culture. We say that hunting is very important. This is a kind of normal, this typical design, and also the geometric design too. Yeah, and there are many interesting interpretations possible. I'm not getting into this deep discussion about which hunter has this meaning, but which angel has a meaning, that kind of stuff. But it could be interesting, getting into that direction too.
Okay. All right. Terrific. Okay. Well, thank you very much again, Yuka. Here's a question about whether any testing has been done on the material of the carpet to determine its place of origin in Iran.
There are this kind of carbon C dating and that kind of stuff. In Iran, probably this the carpet museum in Tehran did some scientific work, I guess. Surely yes, there are some studies on this the scientific analysis, like dyeing and all this. True. Yes.
Okay, well, that's really it. Thank you very much again. We'll see this on YouTube. And once again, thank you, Dr. Kadoy, so much for an absolutely fascinating discussion. So farewell, everybody, and we'll see everybody again in September. Thank you all.